Good evening, everyone. I'm Joseph Cotto, and let me tell you about an epic story of victory, defeat, friendship, betrayal, heroism, cowardice, deep respect, blind hatred, and above all else, the struggle for survival. It is my new book, Runaway Masters, a true story of slavery, freedom, hope, triumph, and tragedy beyond 1619 and 1776. Check it out on Amazon by following the link below. The paperback is $9.99 US dollars, while the Kindle version is $4.99. If you are a Kindle Unlimited subscriber, you are able to read it for free. I hope that you enjoy the book. Please do check it out. And obviously, I'm very glad to be here tonight for a Q&A discussion. As a matter of fact, I have to get the link to Streamlabs up and out, if ever I could find the damn thing. Here it is. Here we go. Yeah, that's the link. All right. I'm really glad to be here. It's been a while since I did one of these episodes, and I'm very glad to be here for it. So I hope you're glad to be here as well. Let me see here. I'm just going to... There we are. Great. Okay. Yeah, very glad to be here. I hope everyone has been well since the last time I did one of these episodes, and I hope that you were able to find the stream without any issue. Yeah, it's, sometimes, you know, I guess the YouTube does its I don't even know what you would call it, but it definitely does something, and it can make the show a little difficult to find. A lot of people tell me that they don't have the notification that, you know, the show is coming on, that's going to have a live stream, even though they subscribe to it. So I obviously have no control over that. YouTube does whatever the hell it wants to do. It is very much its own animal. And, you know, I'm at its mercy. I really am. It's a good platform for streaming. I will say that. I do like streaming on YouTube. But now Odyssey has come about, and a lot of people love streaming on Odyssey. So that's good, too. You know, whatever works for people. But maybe in time, Cotto Godfrey will go to Odyssey. But the problem is not with the platform itself, Odyssey. The problem is getting the Cotto Godfrey viewership over to Odyssey to catch a stream. And that's something much easier said than done. Obviously, a lot of people are used to YouTube, even if they hate the platform for various totally understandable reasons. And, you know, habits are hard to break. So I would like to do more streaming over at Odyssey, but I don't know that it would be viable for the show right now, even though from all I've seen of Odyssey, it's a very good platform. But anyway, I am definitely here tonight. So if you have a reasonable, responsible question or comment for me, please do leave it via Streamlabs and I will get to it. Obviously before I leave, for those who I guess don't typically tune in for these or who don't see them as uploads or in podcast format, the Q&As where it's just me are typically not as long as they are, you know, where it's me and Paul or me and a guest, or certainly me, Paul, and a guest. So I won't be on terribly long tonight. So if you have something that you'd like me to get to, please do leave it via Streamlabs as long as it's reasonable and responsible, and I shall get to it. Thank you very much in advance. One thing that people have been asking me a bit about is my book. I've obviously been spreading the word about it in a very determined manner, I'll put it that way. And I'm doing so because I believe it's a story that needs to be told. I wrote it specifically because it has a lot of relevance to what's going on today. And I really would hate for it to sort of, you know, slip beneath the cracks, so to speak, of the sidewalk of modern American life, or even, you know, I guess modern life moreover, because you certainly don't have to be an American in order to appreciate this this work of mine. And I'm rather proud of it, dare I say. I'm typically not a boastful guy, but I think I've done something with this that is very much worthwhile. And I really enjoyed writing it. And promoting it is not quite as enjoyable, but it is something that is, you know, has to be done all the same. And I'm not surprised that it's had a good reception thus far. That's not surprising at all. I don't want to sound arrogant there, but I wrote it to be a serious book. But I would hope that people really learn something from it, because it is a book about history. I wrote it so it reads like an epic novel, but it is not fiction. And it's a book about history that speaks to the present day. And it's not a book that does so like by you writing a variant of history that is essentially a political narrative or something to promote a political ideology. That's not what I did at all. My goal, I think the best way to put it, is to offer a deeper understanding of history so people know more about what one might call the human story, and they would then have a clearer, more nuanced, deeper, comprehensively speaking, take on history today. So that was what really inspired me to write this book. Also, of course, I am a Floridian, and the history here does have to do with Florida. And it's something very much overlooked, even by people in Florida. And that to me is very sad. It's very sad indeed. Because what I address is something of such importance to Florida history that if not for the events in this that I mentioned in this book, I would not be here right now. No one would be, really, other than the Seminoles, because there would have been no mass development of Florida, and the state would have remained basically a haven for the Seminoles, even though it was technically controlled by other people. But it's really fascinating. It's a history that's often overlooked, which I addressed, and I'm glad to have done it justice. At least I hope I've done it justice, but I think it's safe to say that I have. Even though I always teeter on not sounding arrogant when it comes to stuff like this. It's kind of hard to, if you think you've done a good job with something, not, I guess, sound a bit full of yourself. But I try not to go too far, and I hope I succeed anyway. What I think I'll do is I will read an excerpt from the book. I think what I should probably do first is read the description of the book so people know what the hell it is I'm talking about. Maybe if you've seen the book on Amazon, you've already read the description, but I will read it here. I think it is I know it is of great relevance to what I've discussed. So anyway, here it goes. For generations, they ruled over blacks and whites. They were, and still are, the Seminoles, the only American Indians who never surrendered to Uncle Sam. Runaways from other tribes, the Seminoles carved a kingdom for themselves out of the wilds of Florida, despite British and Spanish imperialists, theoretically, ruling the day. The Seminoles also enslaved fugitives from American plantations, creating a slaveholding society unlike any other. When the Americans wanted not only their slaves back, but unsurpassed control over Florida, the Seminoles formed a groundbreaking alliance with those who they held in bondage. What happened next is an epic story of victory, defeat, friendship, betrayal, hard truths, damnable lies, integration, segregation, heroism, cowardice, deep respect, blind hatred, and above all else, the struggle for survival. This story has lessons for us all. It challenges the way we view race relations, enslavement in the land of the free, and the nature of American history itself. As many question all three of these subjects and much more, Runaway Masters provides no guidance as to what we should think. It does, however, offer valuable insight on a history oft forgotten or even hidden. And this was the description on the back of the book, which I just read. And the title of the book, of course, if you didn't read it already, is Runaway Masters, a true story of slavery, freedom, triumph, and tragedy beyond 1619. And 1776. And I included, beyond 1619 and 1776, because nowadays there are two narratives of history that tend to take some degree of serious root in the U.S. and even elsewhere about, U.S. history, these ideas about U.S. history. I mean, the 1619 narrative basically holds that America was founded to preserve slavery, black enslaved labor is the real source of wealth of the country historically, and the country is inherently terrible because the real founding of the country was slavery in 1619, even though that was not when slavery started in what's now the United States, at least, not what's now any given state of the United States. The first year that slavery started was really 1565 here in Florida, the transatlantic slave trade I'm referring to. Indians, had their own slaves long before that, different tribes that they conquered and such. But in American Indian culture, being a slave is always, something of profound discussed as something that is thought of as unfathomably awful. And I'm sure, I hope we all find slavery to be disgusting and unfathomably awful. But the American Indians really took it to a level of cultural honor not to be enslaved. So, you know, they would rather die than be enslaved, say, by the Spaniards, who did try to enslave them. But the Indians did, in various tribes, they would take slaves of their own. But the slave trade, as we now know it, the transatlantic slave trade, even though the 1619 Project is all about, you know, it starting in 1619, it really started insofar as what's now the United States goes in 1565. So that's quite a difference, and it took place in Spanish Florida. The reason that Florida is so overlooked is because it was not part of the American Revolution. It remained loyal to the crown, and so it sort of gets airbrushed out of American history before Florida became a territory. And even when Florida did become a territory, it was not a place that was terribly patriotic toward the rest of the U.S. As a matter of fact, Florida's first flag read, "Let us alone." And it said that in big, you know, caps lock letters, "Let us alone." So it was the second state to join the Confederacy. So Florida always was very reluctant, to, really, about an American identity or a U.S. identity. It was reluctant about it. And, you know, even today, there are so many people here from all across the world, let alone across the country, that you don't necessarily get this an all-American feeling about Florida. Parts of it, the ones that are culturally Southern, have certainly more of like a traditionally culturally American, if you will, sentiment. But even there, there's a lot of nostalgia for the Confederacy, so that sort of throws it off. But yeah, Florida definitely is very much an international state that just happens to be part of the U.S. And it's a state that has a very long colonial history with Spain, Britain, and France. And it's a fascinating history, to say the absolute least. But anyway, now that I've mentioned so much about Florida, talking about the book, Runaway Masters, I will read an excerpt of it. I'll read one chapter. I'll read the first chapter, which comes after, you know, the introduction, but I won't read the introduction now. That really doesn't seem terribly relevant, even though I dare say it's a good introduction. Anyway, here goes the first chapter of the book. Even though they were free, each of them toiled, as their forefathers had done, under the beating sun, in fear of not gathering enough crops before the man came around. Here, their freedom was a less benign form of slavery than what was had back in the old country, which was the United States, located just a few miles north in Georgia. Their new home was not even run, technically speaking, by those who they had come to accept as master. In this rough and tumble society, white was effectively at the mercy of red, while blacks found themselves as slaves to white and red alike. White people live in towns where many thousands work together on small grounds, but the Seminole is a wild and scattered people, an unnamed tribal chief explained to a fellow who shall be specified later. The Seminole swims the streams and leaps over the logs of the forest in pursuit of game, and is like the whooping crane that makes its nest at night, far from the spot where it dashed the dew from the grass and flowers in the morning. For 100 summers, the Seminole warrior has rested under the shade of his live oaks, and the suns of 100 winters have risen upon his ardent pursuit of the buck and bear, with none to question or dispute his claims. Among other things, the Seminole claimed blacks as his slaves, and he would not hear any question of this. If a black person disputed this arrangement, the Seminole had no qualm in settling the matter in only the most decisive of fashions. Fortunately for both sides of this divide, violence was rarely a serious prospect. The blacks who live under Seminole control in what was nominally Spanish Florida were, as a rule, just happy to no longer be tilling the fields of plantations in Georgia and other southern jurisdictions. The Seminole had no interest in micromanaging the daily routine of his slaves. He was too busy dominating the white man's land. The Seminoles, fundamentally, are Muscogee Creeks whose ancestors lived in what are now Alabama and Georgia. Eventually, certain bands of these Creeks migrated southward until they were on Floridian soil, where they stayed for generations, beginning in the 1700s, developing their own unique culture. Seminole is the Anglicization of Simano Lee, itself the Muskogization of Cimarron, which is the Spanish word for runaway. These creeks, becoming known as Seminoles as the years passed, lived under the Spanish and British crowns without much issue. The Spanish were stretched too thin across their far-flung empire to really try at colonizing Florida, save for a few remote communities. The British, on the other hand, earnestly attempted to colonize the land once they purchased it from Spain in 1763. The Britons made more progress at bringing about political, legal, economic, and social development than the Spanish had in the 250 years previous. Regrettably, the American Revolution depleted the United Kingdom of requisite funds to sustain its Floridian enterprise. Britain sold Florida back to Spain in 1783, and that is when the fun really began for the red man, not the white one. Quite a bit of fun there was indeed for the Seminole. And it's, I think you could gather, I named the book Runaway Masters because the Seminoles were called, you know, a runaway people for the reason that I just described. And the Seminoles were masters not only over their black slaves, but effectively over the land, which was, in theory, run by someone else, whether it be the Spanish, the British, or the Americans, though the Americans are the ones who really made an effort to take control of the land, and that's why the Seminole Wars happened, which, of course, are addressed in the book. The book, I think, really is relevant to a lot of stuff that's going on today. It tells a history that is very much overlooked, to be kind, and it really has something worthwhile to communicate about the human story. I think I priced it reasonably well, $9.99 US for a paperback, at $4.99 US for a Kindle version. If you have Kindle Unlimited, of course, you can read it for free. So that's the situation there. I have been talking a lot about the book, as I've been mentioning, and I will keep talking about it because it is important. It's not just like a novel that one writes to pass the time or whatnot. It's a very serious book that is something something really relevant to communicate. It's something that's not just a great importance to the past, but our present. So that is the situation there. I hope you check out the book. I really enjoyed writing it. And so that's the situation with that. I don't even know if I have, included another link to the to Streamlabs, but I shall do so here. It's been a while since I did one of these shows. It really has been. The Q&A with just me, but I do enjoy them, so that's pretty cool. I do like them. I don't know if they'll be on for very long though. Okay, let me see if there's anything on Streamlabs since I've been discussing the book. If there isn't, that's all right, but please get your stuff as soon as you can because I won't be around very long, maybe only about 40 or so minutes tonight. It's interesting because, you know, it's just when you do a show that is a show that is just you talking, it's a bit more, it's not more difficult. For me, it's very natural, but you do kind of run out of, the conversation just goes quicker, I'll put it that way. And you, it makes for a shorter episode, even if you feel that you've addressed perhaps more things than if you were doing an episode with a lot of other people, or just even one other person. Although, you know, with Paul, he typically dominates the conversation because he has so much to share, so much knowledge to impart. And I learned something when I listened to him, as I'm sure everyone learns something when they listen to him. So that's really, it's a different experience, and that's great as well. But I don't mind this either. So that's that's the situation there. What I will, you know, I guess what's worth noting is that when it comes to the summer months, the ratings, if you will, the amount of viewership, listenership, whatever, of all programs tends to plummet. It plummets in, I believe, June and July and August, and then picks up again in the fall. Why this happens, I mean, I guess obviously people are out doing things, and that's good. It's fun. If you go out and do something grand, that's a good move. Nothing to complain about. But, you know, of course, in the summertime, though, it makes for shows that are more difficult to get a large number of people to watch or listen to or whatever. It's just something that you really have to deal with. It's something that you learn to adapt to over time. And, you know, after a while, it's just something that's basically a fact of life. Some hosts of some streams tend to, or podcasts, they tend to get a little angry about it, but I don't. So for me, it's just, you know, whatever. But anyway, it's good that people are out doing things, having fun. Perhaps last summer they didn't get to do a lot of things because of lockdowns or riots or whatever. And so this summer they're making up for it. I hope that they are at least, you know, having a good time with whatever fun stuff it is they're doing outside. Fun in the sun, as the saying goes. So that's my take there. And, you know, it's interesting, I suppose, looking at current events now, because since the Democrats are not going to get much through the U.S. Senate because of the filibuster being maintained, I don't want to say it's boring, but it's sort of, the situation is pleasantly devoid of any news. Or, I mean, there is news, but it's devoid of any groundbreaking news. And that's fine by me. That's the way I like politics being. The only problem, of course, is the problems are the unfortunate administrative policies coming out of the Biden-Harris administration. And they call it the Biden-Harris administration. I'm not being cute. So I'm just, you know, saying what it is. And I think that soon enough, Biden will resign and it'll just become the Harris administration. And we'll see if that makes any difference at all in terms of, you know, administrative policy. Somehow I doubt it. But, you know, I think she's basically running the show now with a consortium of others behind the scenes. So I don't think there'll be that much of a difference when Biden eventually does resign. My take is that they're waiting for the midterms to have taken place. And then in early 2023, Biden will resign for Kamala Harris. Although if he has some sort of health issue beforehand, then obviously that would speed up the timeline. But I do think that they want Kamala Harris to stick around as vice president until 2023, because if she becomes president from 2023 onward, they would see her as a potential 10-year executive. So she'd be able to run for two terms in addition to, you know, running she'd be able to run. Well, I mean, I need to be clear about that. It could be a little confusing, but they would see her as a candidate that could obviously serve out the remainder of Biden's term and then run for two terms thereafter. And a lot of Republicans say she can't win. She can never win. She's not popular enough, blah, blah, blah. I don't buy that. I really don't buy that. I think that Kamala Harris could, in fact, win the presidency in 2024, and she could win it in 2028 as well, and then she could win it in 2032. I think that, wait a second, I'm terrible with numbers. You have to excuse me here. She'd be a 10-year president, so she would win in 2024, and then she would win again, yes, in 2028. She would win in 2024 and 2028, and then she would not run in 2032, obviously. My apologies there. But I could absolutely see that happening. I really could. There are more and more of what I call cultural democratic voters in the country, and they are positioned well in key swing states. And what makes a voter culturally democratic is a tendency to view politics through the lens of identity politicking. And in that case, you don't vote based on issue by issue. What you vote on is your personal identity, and you are tribally loyal to the party that you perceive as furthering the interests of your identity, whether it's your individual identity or your group identity. Both of them, probably, almost certainly. So it's, and there are different identities that people have, but they perceive the Democrats as better serving these identities than the GOP does, and so they will vote blue no matter who, as a fairly new saying goes. And the GOP simply cannot compete with that, because there's no way of reaching the voters who do this. They vote the way they vote because they like it, because they like it for something that goes beyond, you know, conventional issue by issue politicking. And it's really a form of self-expression through voting. And if you try to appeal to someone on the basis of issues, when they are engaged in an act of self-expression, they're not going to give a damn about the issues, because that's simply not what they're interested in. They're interested in themselves and expressing themselves in a manner they believe is beneficial. And so that's what it means to be a someone who votes on the basis of identity politics. And the Democrats have absolutely crushed it in a good way when it comes to getting voters out to support candidate A or candidate B on the basis of identity politicking. The GOP simply has it cannot compete with that. So I think that when you look at all these voters across the country, specifically in key swing states, or what used to be swing states, now they're just becoming Democratic states, the Democratic voting bloc is largening with each passing election cycle. And these people don't care how bad Kamala is. They probably won't like her, but they'll vote for her anyway. And they'll turn out in huge numbers to vote for her because they'll perceive the Republican as no matter what, worse. And an even, you know, more perilous than just being bad on the issues. They perceive this Republican as an existential peril to their personal or group identity. So these people, you know, the GOP is not going to reason with them. And the Democrats probably are going to get them out to vote in big numbers, for at least for a presidential election. And Kamala Harris being on the ticket would not be an impediment to a Democratic victory. So the Republicans who think that Kamala Harris is, you know, somehow destined to lose, she can't lose, she can't win, she's not popular enough, blah, blah, blah. I think these people are fooling themselves. And that's a very sad thing for a host of reasons. And I would hope that they wake up sooner than later, because Kamala Harris absolutely can win. She can win the presidency to the extent that she would have it for 10 years' time. Now, whether or not the Republicans would hold on to Congress is a totally different story. I think that the Republicans, as time passes, are well positioned to hold the U.S. Senate in many, many election cycles, not just like one or two. And I think that they're also probably positioned to do quite well in the U.S. House, although that's going to recede with time, I think. But for the next decade or two, I think they'll be very, very competitive in the U.S. House, and they'll control it quite often. Not always, but often. I think there's a decent chance that at least one chamber of the Senate will be in the hands, one chamber of Congress will be in the hands of the GOP, even if the presidency is not. And I think that the presidency itself is going to slip away from the Republicans probably by the early 2030s. At that point, I don't see the GOP as having really a viable path forward in terms of presidential politics. What's happening is that you had in the old, not the old days, but not so long ago, Virginia was a swing state. Before that, it was just a Republican state, like it was when I was a boy. But Virginia used to be considered a swing state. Colorado, same thing. Then they became, you know, these safe Democratic states. Then you had Georgia and Arizona. They were these Republican states that were, you know, trending a bit toward the Democrats, but who cares? And then they went to the Democrats in 2020. Of course, there was fraud, but there was still enough legitimate sentiment in favor of the Democrats to be close enough so that the fraud could transpire. And the fraud especially, I think, was present in Georgia. But you have these legit Democratic voting blocs that are growing in these two states. And now, while they're still, you could call them swing states, but I think they're really lean Democratic states. So the Democrats are advancing tremendously in presidential politics. They keep getting all these states on their side that didn't used to be. And of course, the GOP has done better in Florida, in Iowa, and in Ohio. But, you know, it's good. It's better than, certainly far better than nothing, but it's not enough. And also, the Democrats are doing, they came very close to winning North Carolina in 2020. They obviously won it in 2008. So I do fear about North Carolina, but they have a strong Republican Party there that sort of manages to, at least in presidential races, hold the state with a robust turnout operation, even though they don't always hold state offices for the Republican Party. But the big deal coming up now is Texas. Texas is a problem. As a matter of fact, in the early 2000s, Texas went to the GOP by double digits, and it was nothing that was even thought of as vaguely close. It was looked at basically as Idaho was looked at today for the Republicans, and as it was looked at back then. But then Texas started to become much closer by the late 2000s. John McCain lost tremendous ground relative to George W. Bush. Mitt Romney did not gain back all the ground that McCain lost. And then Trump came was the first Republican in decades to come within 9 points, less than 10 points of losing the state. And then it went down to 6 points in the 2020 election. And that's not because of fraud. That's not that, you know, you can't blame that on fraud. What's just happening in Texas is that there are more and more Democratic voters being produced there every year. And that's, you know, even in this year's municipal elections in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, the Republicans did very poorly. So it's a bad situation in Texas. And it will go to the Democrats. It's only just a question of when it goes to them. I think that the Republicans will be able to hold Texas in not next year's. Well, you'd probably 2022, but they'll probably have a much narrower hold than ever before. No, at least ever before in recent times. I mean. But if you look at the Democrats in 2024 in the presidential race, the next one, I think they'll come within 1 to 3 points of winning Texas. I don't think they'll quite clinch it, but I think they'll come within 1 to 3 points. And I think that by 2028, they'll have won it. Maybe the GOP will be able to hold them off one last time, the last hurrah. But by 2032, I think Texas will be unambiguously a Democratic-leaning state in presidential elections. And at that point, the GOP is not going to have a leg to stand on when it comes to presidential races. It's just not. So I think that it should begin to forget about presidential elections, and it should focus on winning both houses of Congress as well as key state governments, as well as important local governments as well, whether it be county or municipal. Whenever they can win the Republicans, they should try to win. And they should do so without apology. So that's my take as to what the political future holds for the GOP and presidential politics. I am not optimistic about it at all. And I don't know how you could seriously look at the situation and feel optimistic, at least from a Republican perspective. But of course, you know, to each his own, as the old saying goes. I'm not going to pretend to... have a crystal ball, but my take is pretty solid, I would say, on this issue. Anyway, I will throw this out there again. If you have a reasonable, responsible question or comment for yours truly, please do leave it via Streamlabs, and I shall get to it. Thank you very much in advance. I won't be on for terribly long tonight. It's said be on for about 40 or so minutes. I might be on for about 45. We'll see. So if you have anything that you'd like me to get to, as long as it's reasonable and responsible, please leave it by Streamlabs and I will get to it. Thank you very much. So I am sort of downcast about the GOP's future in presidential races. Now, there is something else that's going on. There is this tendency to exalt Ron DeSantis as the sort of godlike figure that has all of the benefits of Trump without any of the drawbacks. And that's simply not true. I mean, DeSantis has been a fine governor. He deserves re-election. I'm not opposed to that at all. I voted for him in 2018 in the general election, not the primary. But I have known about Ron DeSantis for about over 10 years now. And he's not... He's someone who's very bland and uninspiring on his own. He needs someone else in order to make him have some degree of serious appeal among the population. It could be Trump. It could be Trump's 2016 campaign manager who saved Ron's bacon in the 2018 gubernatorial race. Or it could be Ron DeSantis's wife, Casey. She has been giving him a lot of coaching, and she's a profound influence on his public image. But when Ron is left to his own devices, he absolutely fails. I saw that in gory detail in 2018 when he was running against Andrew Gillum, and he made some innocuous comment using the old, you know, phrase, don't monkey this up. But people, for whatever reason, perceived that as a racial slur against Gillum, which it obviously was not. And DeSantis basically just crawled into fetal position while the world went by around him, and Gillum, you know, ran circles around the poor bastard. So, you know, that was something else. And then Ron also is not a guy who has much loyalty. He's very notorious for not treating those in his orbit with a great deal of fidelity, we'll put it that way. And a good example of this was in early 2019, when he just assumed office, Ron appointed a very highly regarded fellow out of Seminole County, which is in Greater Orlando. It's where Sanford is where the George Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin affair exploded. This fellow, his name was Michael Urtel. He was the election supervisor of Seminole County. Had an impeccable track record. Ron appointed him state secretary of state. And within a few days, Urtel resigned because somebody came out with a picture of him with his face painted at some party, a blackface thing from 2005. That was 14 years ago by the time this, scandal erupted. And DeSantis did not come out in support of Urtel. Urtel wound up resigning on his own accord. I don't know if he was pressured to do so. I imagine he was. But DeSantis publicly said that he was glad that Urtel resigned because Urtel had become a distraction. And it was a very cold-blooded thing. It was especially interesting because Ron's supposed to be anti-political correctness, all this stuff. But it's well in keeping with how he's treated others in his administration. He does not have the sort of loyalty that Trump very much exudes toward those who have been loyal to him. And that sort of thing isn't just a matter of administrative, work. It's not just a matter of who his staff is and how he treats his staff. It's a personality thing. And it boils over into politics. People really like Trump because they trusted him. They didn't always agree with him, but they trusted him to be genuine in his feelings and to make decisions that he thought were best. That trust factor with Trump is immense. And people really trusted Trump because he stuck to his guns, even when, all hell was coming down around him and he refused to play games. And Ron obviously does play games, such as with poor Michael Urtel. So DeSantis is not a bad guy, but he is a career politician. He obviously was in the military and he was a lawyer there. I'm not taking that away from him, but he does earn his income from politics, say, unlike Trump. And that makes him, I think, especially sensitive toward what the media is saying, even though he's very aggressive in defending himself against the media. But I think he also goes out of his way not to do anything that would make him very unpopular in the media, even though he does sign stuff like, say, Florida's recent elections bill, which is outstanding, which he's getting all the credit for, even though the credit goes to the people in the legislature who wrote it up and passed it through both houses, but whatever. But he signed that because in Florida, you don't have anything like the National Press Corps. In Florida, the press corps is very small. It's not very much listened to. The state press corps in Tallahassee, And so he could do all that stuff and get away with it, really, because it's not going to make any difference to his reelection in terms of, what the media thinks of him regarding this stuff. But if he were president, he'd be dealing with a totally different beast. He'd be dealing with the D.C. press corps. And I think he absolutely would then go the Michael Urtel route and be very SJW is a bit strong, but I think he'd be very much more PC than most folks imagine. And I absolutely think he would turn on people who are unjustly smeared by the media, which, is is out against anyone to the right of where Barack Obama was in 2008. So I keep trying to find ways to put this so I don't make a generalization or so I don't sound offensive. But DeSantis has been a fine governor. He absolutely deserves re-election. I think he'll win it very easily. But at the same time, I think his fans online greatly misinterpret his record, or they're probably very ignorant about it, to be blunt. And they seem to think he's some perfect version of Trump when he's not. He's really not. He's not a bad guy, but he's not what people perceive. He was a Tea Partier when he got into Congress, and he basically had the voting record of a Bush Republican. As a matter of fact, Ron did not embrace Donald Trump in the 2016 election. He embraced him after the 2016 election. He very consciously kept a distance from Trump during the 2016 presidential race. And of course, Ron became very famous for his MAGA activism in Congress. But this was not what Ron did when the election was actually at hand in 2016. I think that there's a good chance Ron really does not care for Trump all that much, but he just used the MAGA thing very cynically, opportunistically. And that would make some sense because, you know, Ron got into Congress as a Tea Partier, but he basically had the voting record of a Bush Republican, George W. Bush Republican, very neocon-centric. And then Ron ran for the U.S. Senate in 2016, but he dropped out before the primary. And then, you know, he was basically in a situation where his career was at a standstill, but he didn't want to even jeopardize that by becoming too pro-Trump. But when Trump won, he then opportunistically attached himself to Trump. And then when Ron won the primary in 2018, the gubernatorial primary, he distanced himself from Trump again. And Trump was not pleased about that. And Ron, I think, thought he could basically shed the Trump image and just be what he wanted to be. But when Ron ran as himself, or the image he was projecting of himself on the campaign trail, he completely floundered. He cratered, and Gillum was running circles around him. And then Ron had to go running back to Donald Trump, and he got Trump's 2016 Florida campaign manager, the magnificent Susie Wiles, who's without doubt the best operative in Florida in either party. And then Ron very narrowly won the 2018 election. Yeah, we're talking about Florida, and I just noticed I'm drinking Diet Orange soda. I guess it's pretty fitting. So my point about DeSantis is not that he's a bad guy. It's not that he's, you know, some sort of villain or anything like that. But people are absolutely getting carried away with him, and they're making the fella into something which he simply is not. And that's very bad for a host of reasons, most of which have absolutely nothing to do with DeSantis or Trump or the Republican Party, or this or that or the other thing. It's just about people not doing something that essentially turns politicians into people deserving of worship, because the only people who benefit by this are politicians, specifically those who don't want to focus on the issues and who want to manipulate the public for their own gain. So that's my take there, and I hope that I've delivered it in a very fair and balanced and nuanced way. So, there's a lot to talk about when it comes to DeSantis. And I've been following his career since before he ran. I don't know if he actually had announced his candidacy yet, but I heard that he was running in 2011 in a congressional district that was my own, but it was becoming a different district. It was getting redistricted. So I took some interest in the race for that reason. And that's the situation there. Ron was elected to Congress in late 2012, and he started serving his first term in early 2013, but I did hear about him in 2011. Now getting to Streamlabs. By the way, folks, this is going to be not the last call, but the call before the last call. So I'm going to post it right now. If you have a reasonable and responsible question or comment for yours truly, please do leave it via Streamlabs and I will get to it. But leave it as soon as you can. Thank you very much. Okie dokie, let's see here. From Dr. Khan blog. If your analysis is correct, the best course for the right is to claw away presidential and federal power and accept countercultural status. Plus, if one wants to be an expat, do so. 110% correct, Dr. Khan blog. Absolutely. The right should focus on increasing federalism and regionalism in the U.S. It should try to phase out various federal agencies and curb the oversight of federal agencies and, you know, allow the states and even local governments to do this stuff instead. That's exactly what it should be doing, because it does not have a rosy future in presidential politics, even though it will be able to hold influence in Congress for decades to come. Of that, I'm sure. As long as there's not something like H.R. 1, by the way, or adding, you know, three new Democratic states, which would have six new Democratic U.S. senators. I mean, though these are wild cards. We're talking about the situation persisting as it is. But as long as it does persist as it is, I think the GOP will be quite relevant in Congress for some time to come. And as far as being an expat goes, absolutely, people should be looking in the U.S., people who are politically reasonable, I would say, to have some place to go to in case things get very bad here, which I think they will. I think eventually the country will be like New York and California, very sad to say. And people might say I'm exaggerating, but if you look at H.R. 1, if you look at how serious the Democrats are about stacking the Supreme Court, packing the court, actually, that'd be a better way of putting it. If you look at that new law passed in San Jose, which makes gun owners pay for gun crimes that they had absolutely nothing to do with, it's clear where the Democrats are going, and it's in a radically left-wing direction. So there's no reason to think that these people get power at the national level. They won't basically have some sort of leftist totalitarian state. From K-Max McDonald, Cotto, why was the DeSantis versus Gillum election so close? What makes you think this re-election will not be as close in 2022? Well, Ron is a very popular governor here in Florida, and he does not need to have the same sort of charisma or, you know, public image that he would need to win a presidential election in order to win the governorship again. His handling of coronavirus here has been very popular. His handling of the disaster at Surfside, the condo collapse, has been extremely popular down there. Also in Florida, the Republicans are gaining more and more people in terms of voter registration. And that's especially the case down in South Florida, which has traditionally been very Democratic. So DeSantis winning re-election in big numbers, also because he has some very pathetic Democratic opposition that's not even worth mentioning, that they can't even raise, you know, big anything close to big numbers. I'm talking about, you know, obviously the donations that they get. You know, DeSantis is going to easily win re-election next year, I believe. And I think everyone else believes that too, basically. He does not have the Democrats are losing power numerically. He does not have anything close to Andrew Gillum as opposition. And DeSantis himself is quite popular here. So he will win re-election, I believe. He might even win it by close to double digits, who knows, which in Florida is a true accomplishment, and nobody could take that away from Ron. But even polls that typically, you know, would show the Democrat and the Republican like this in Florida, or the Democrat maybe inching a bit ahead, they show Ron now leading his opponents by some pretty crazy margins. So, you know, I don't take public polling seriously, of course, but if even these polls that are typically off in favor of the Democrats show Ron doing so well, I'm not inclined to believe that he has any serious chance of losing re-election next year. I just don't think that's going to happen. As far as why DeSantis versus Gillum was so close, that was because Ron was a piss-poor candidate and Gillum was an excellent candidate. I never thought Gillum would win, even though most everyone else did. And I never thought he'd win because I knew that his views were simply too left-wing to win a statewide race in Florida. But he came very close. And he came very close because he was a candidate that was able to get a maximal number of Democrats out. And Ron, meanwhile, was someone who was just a terrible campaigner. He was running ads about Little League while DeSantis was running ads about healthcare. And then Ron could not defend himself against a total bullshit leftist media onslaught when Ron talked about monkeying things up, and people said he was making a racial slur against Gillum, which he definitely was not. But Ron just basically curled into fetal position as the whole of the national media and even the international media came down upon him. And Ron did distance himself from Trump after he won his gubernatorial nomination. The only reason Ron won that nomination is because of Trump. So Ron was beginning to turn off Trump voters. He was, you know, looking like a total weakling against Gillum and looked very, very bad for him. Now, he was able to pull it out because he got back in Trump's good graces and because he hired Trump's 2016 campaign manager, Susie Wiles. She really steered a course for him of discipline and of as close to personability as you could get with Ron for the rest of the campaign. And Donald Trump gave him his blessing. So he already given him his blessing, but Ron, you know, sort of backing away from Trump needed, it required a new infusion of Trumpism, if you will. And that's what got Ron across the finish line, that the backing of Trump and Trump's 2016 campaign manager, Susie Wiles. The election did not have to be that close. It shouldn't have been that close, but Ron was just that bad of a candidate, and Gillum was that good of a candidate to make something like that happen. Now, the Democrats have lost so much ground, even since 2018, that you would today, I think Ron, even making all the stupid moves that he made back then, I think he would still wind up doing better than he did back in the day. just because the Democrats have lost so many voters in Florida. And but I, just because the Democrats, in terms of their share of the electorate, they're declining, and the Republicans are gaining. Because of that, I think that, you know, Ron would do better today than he did back then. But he did so much worse in 2018 than he had to do that it really was shameful. And I don't like, you know, using that word shame. So it tends to, you know, be people when they use it to control other people. Through, you know, public onslaught of emotional sentiment. That's not what I'm doing here. But Ron just did the way he performed was shameful. It almost boggles the mind because it was like he's actively making his situation worse in 2018, which was, to, you know, almost unbelievable. So that was the situation there. Very good questions, K-Max. From Dr. Bob, Cotto, China's birth rate is currently at 1.7 births per woman. The U.S. is at 1.75. Given immigration, the U.S. will have 500 million in 2100, and China will have 600. How do you see this impacting global politics? Is it the biggest threat from Muslim nations? I think that China will overtake the U.S., as a world power. I think it's already in the process of doing that. I think the future of the 21st century, just to say the mid to late 21st century, will be a contest, a very grand contest between India and China. I think the U.S.'s birth rate will continue to plummet, and China, just because there's so many more people who are used to living in third world conditions, and yet they're so patriotic to their country, I think that China will be able to turn this to their advantage, whereas the U.S. obviously would not. So I think that the U.S. birth rate will fall. China's birth rate, they obviously wanted it to fall because, you know, they had such a terrible problem with overpopulation. But now they're trying to encourage people to have kids once again. And I think that'll probably be pretty successful because in China, people tend to be used to doing whatever the government tells them to do. And it's, I can't see that changing. I think that in terms of global politics, the U.S. by 2100 might not even exist, to be blunt. To think that it will be around then is quite a presumption. I see the U.S. going down the Soviet path where you just have this, you know, empire without a crown that becomes so, how do you put this, so burdened by its own ineptitude that it basically can no longer administer its provinces. So that's what I see happening to the U.S., what happened to the Soviet Union. Like the U.S., the Soviet Union had no common culture. It tried to have a sense of fraternity through ideas rather than, you know, a shared, rather than borders, language, and culture, which is how nations traditionally have defined themselves. And the Soviet Union collapsed because its identity was very weak, this identity of ideas. And then when it no longer had the money to back this up, it just, you know, it went down the tubes. I think the U.S. will go down the exact same road. And to think that it'll be around in 2100, like I said, is quite a presumption. I mean, people obviously can think what they want to think. I'm not here to tell people they're right or they're wrong. Nobody knows who will be right or wrong about this, obviously, until 2100. Or until, you know, America should cease to exist before then, you would know that obviously the country wouldn't be around in 2100. But I just think that China will make it in the long run. It's a very versatile and adaptable country that has a real hunger for power. And the U.S. has traditionally been versatile and adaptable with a hunger for power. Now it's become so Soviet-like where it has all these internal divisions and it has this economy that does not function nearly as well as it once did. And it has this government that's burdened by debt with a bureaucracy that basically trips itself up. I just, you know, I really don't see the U.S. Making it in the long run. I just don't. Now, as far as global politics would go, obviously, like I said, it'd be a clash between Russia. It's not Russia. Not Russia. China and India in the mid to late 21st century. And as far as Muslim nations go, Turkey, it's theoretically is a secular state, but it's become much more Islamized since Erdogan and his party took power. They could pose a threat, the Turkish military, could pose a threat to Europe, to southern Europe. Turkey theoretically could take that whole thing over And that'll be interesting to see what might happen, because obviously in the past, the Turks have controlled Southern Europe and in Eastern Europe as well. I'll throw that in there. And the European Union, it seems to be something that's even though it wants more power, it wants a standing army, I don't think it's going to make it in the long run either, probably for many of the same reasons the U.S. is unlikely to. So I could definitely see Turkey controlling Southern Europe within the next century. I don't know that it will, but I just think it's possible. Now, I think in the U.S., the immigration from certain Muslim countries, which tends to produce people that are religiously radical, is a problem. And I think it will continue to be a domestic security problem going forward, because you just have so many of these people and they're so used to living in cells and they are very decentralized, but at the same time, they have a huge propensity for violence and they plan things out at a very high level. That's a terrible problem. And I think that this will continue to be a problem for the U.S. as time goes on. I don't ever see that ending. And I think this will be a problem even for any successor state to the U.S. or any developed Western or even Eastern maybe country. This I think is a real problem, and I don't see it ending. The only way it would end is if the Muslim world, particularly in poor countries, were to secularize, which there are some signs actually that might be happening. But talking about secularization there, it's a relative term. People would think of as something being secularized in these places would be like the West secularizing as it did maybe 400 years ago. So, you know, it is relative. It absolutely is. From Mark, great questions, by the way, Dr. Bob. From Mark Urzhavec, Nick Fuentes got banned by Twitter. Indeed, he did. Yes, he did. He really did not say anything specific to get him banned, as far as I can tell. He had me blocked on Twitter, but I did see, you know, images of his tweets, and I never heard about him. People actually said he didn't say anything to get banned. What happened was that there were two reports that came out about him in a short period of time, one from the SPLC and another from the ADL. And I think that these reports are really what got him banned. Which one did, I don't know. It seemed to me that the SPLC and the ADL were trying to jockey for the position of the person who got Fuentes banned. I don't know that you can really say one or another is responsible for it alone. It's probably a combination of both. But it is, you know, unfortunate that the censorship rolls on. And, you know, if you don't like Fuentes, it doesn't take a genius to see that somebody getting banned for, by all appearances, not violating the platform's community guidelines. It's a terrible thing. And it, whatever one feels about Fuentes, the manner in which he was banned is not good. It simply is not. And I would hope that people realize this, or put aside whatever feelings about the guy that they might have, to come to terms with this glaring reality. So it is unfortunate. It is unfortunate. And, you know, like I said, he had me blocked, so it's not like we were on a friendly base. See, though, I didn't say anything bad to him at all. I wasn't, you know, harassing him or anything like that on Twitter. One day I just saw that he had blocked me, and I was pretty, you know, surprised by that. I actually wondered if maybe he had thought that I said something I didn't say to him, but he just blocked my account. So whatever, you know, there's really not much more to say about it, because I'm not in his head. I can't figure out why he did what he did, but it was childish. I'll say that much, to block me, because I wasn't harassing. I wasn't directing people to harass him. I wasn't, you know, writing things to him that were intended to stir up any kind of hatred or whatnot. It was really weird. But as I understand it, he blocks lots of people, so I was not alone. But yes, he did block me. You know, I did ask him to come on Kato Godfrey when he was banned from YouTube. I wanted to share his side of the story, but he never got back to me, interestingly enough. I think that he didn't like that I had JF Gariepy on. Gariepy's the one who basically got Fuentes banned. So I think he didn't like the fact that I had Gariepy on and that I gave Gariepy a fair shake. But I asked Fuentes to come on as well, and not to come on to debate Gariepy, just to come on to share his side of the story on a standalone episode. But he never got back to me. So that was weird. I never, you know, I certainly was not doing any, I certainly never came to the point of blocking him, I'll put it that way. So that was, yeah, that was strange, very strange. But still, he did not deserve to get permanently suspended from Twitter as he was. But, you know, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? That's life. All right, folks, now I will make the last call. This is the last call. If you have a reasonable, responsible question or comment for me, please do leave it via Streamlabs. Thank you very much in advance. I said I would go for 40 to 45 minutes. Now I've been on for an hour. This does happen sometimes where I'm about ready to go and then, you know, things finally start picking up. What are you going to do? I'm glad that things did pick up. These are always fun conversations. And there we go. I'm leaving the stuff in the chat right now. The last call. It is there. I have seen it. It is there. Okay. Let me see if anything else came up here while I was talking about that. I will refresh Streamlabs. I'll try to do a show with Paul tomorrow. I don't know if we'll be able to do it. Might have to do it on Monday. We'll see. But I would very much like to do one with Paul tomorrow. I think we would have a great conversation. There are two things here on Streamlabs. From K-Max McDonald, Cotto, you often say you pull to the right, but you are left-wing on other issues. I wouldn't say left-wing. Well, what people who are on the right might perceive as being on the left, but I wouldn't identify it as left-wing. But, you know, this is a matter of perception. So I'll start the whole thing over. Cotto, you often say you pull to the right, but are left-wing on other issues. Besides abortion, what else? Is it just not being very religious? You seem conservative on all other issues. Maybe just religion, you are not conservative. I very much favor abortion rights. I favor rights for sexual minorities. I favor women being able to live as they like. I don't like the whole trad thing. I do favor like doing away with stuff such as obscenity laws. I favor a very individualistic society where people can do as they will. I favor the legalization of prostitution between adults, as long as it's consensual, of course. Let's see what else. I favor assisted suicide. What else do I favor? What else do I favor that some people might perceive as being left-wing? Economically, I'm not left-wing, even though I support tariffs and, if necessary, price controls, stuff like that. But I dislike income taxation. And, you know, taxation that really stymies economic growth. I do favor, you know, taxation, though. I'm not like some sort of anarchist at all. It's just I think the taxation has to be done in a smart fashion. Let's see. What else might people say I am left-wing on? Well, I obviously favor the separation between church and state. I don't like people forcing their views on each other, regardless of what end of the political spectrum they're on. But in favoring the separation between church and state, I favor it not only to keep the state free of religious influence, but to keep religions free of state influence, which is tremendously important. Because once you start having politicized religion, as we're seeing now in the U.S. with, you know, woke Christianity, and as we saw back in the day with George W. Bush and the religious right, once you start having that, the organized religions themselves just become political action committees and become corrupted, obviously. And they lead people to do very bad things in the name of religion. So I favor the separation between church and state, to keep the state free of religious influence and then to keep the religions free of state influence. It goes both ways. I think it's a very good perspective. And I do favor religious liberty as an individual right. If you want to worship Jesus or if you want to worship a tree log, you should be able to do that without the state getting involved. And people, you know, should not be able to prevent you from doing this, even if they're not, you know, part of the state. So the state should protect your right to do this, but at the same time, you should not force your beliefs on the state. That's my point of view here. So that sums that up. Is there anything else that people say I'm quote-unquote left-wing on? Obviously, I favor birth control. I generally favor sexual liberation, as one might say, as long as this is being done in a healthy way, which doesn't, you know, victimize people. That's a big thing. Obviously, I don't think that kids should have any of this stuff, you know, forced into their domain as we see now happening across the country. I think that that's a very, very bad thing. But I think that would be the extent of my views that people might describe as left-wing, even though I wouldn't call them left-wing. That's basically it. There might be some other stuff that I'm forgetting. Oh, yeah. There is something else, actually, because I think I began to mention this before, there are the narratives of American history, 1619 and 1776, the two big ones. The two big ones. And the 1619 narrative I mentioned before, but I forgot about the 1776 narrative. I'll do that right now. The 1776 narrative basically holds that America was this place founded totally on rights and liberties, and the founders were like deities who did, even when they did things that were not nice, which we're not supposed to talk about, they did them for the right reasons, and they were not motivated by profit or anything like that. The King of England was evil. Parliament was evil. The colonies who didn't go along with the American Revolution were lackeys who were proto-communists. This total bullshit narrative that a lot of people on the right promote about the founding of America, I stand against it 100%. I'm not a 1619 guy, obviously. I critiqued that before. But the 1776 narrative also is nonsense. And it's all very self-serving dreck. And by the way, a lot of the same people who promote the 1776 narrative are the same ones who say that the Union was great. The Civil War came down on the right of side of history, came down on the side of individual rights and liberties. Meanwhile, there was Sherman's March to the Sea. Meanwhile, there was the only pogrom in American history. There was all this stuff. And of course, Reconstruction, where people were dispossessed of their land and their rights under the law. The 1776 narrative is very poisonous. That's not to say that 1619 is not poisonous. It is. But the 1776 narrative, which a lot of people on the right promote about America, is very, very degenerate. And it's very much a misrepresentation of history. That's not to say 1619 is not a degenerate misrepresentation of history. But one cannot deny that 1776 is not accurate either. So that's my take there. That definitely does separate me from a lot of people on the right. I take an honest view of these things, and I try to have as much nuance as possible with a desire to see as many documented facts as possible so I can reach the most well-rounded and accurate of opinions about American history as one might hope to attain. And also from K. Max McDonald, as a matter of fact, I need to hang on one second. From K. Max, Cotto, the fact that Paul appeared with Pat Casey and he has no organization anymore, can he be a guest now? I think that he could. I gave an email and I figured if he responds, should be fine with you. He has a YouTube channel himself, and put it on Rumble. He would be good. I think it'd be fine to speak with Casey. I'll do a little checking, but I think Paul and I could probably chat with him as long as he's interested, of course. Later in the summer, I don't see any real problem with that. I think Casey knows how to keep himself in check, so to speak. And I think that Casey really, ever since he came out against Fuentes, I've not heard about him being, you know, targeted by SPLC or ADL or anything like that. I think that Pat Casey now is not someone who the leftist overlords find particularly problematic. I think when he came out against Fuentes, that was sort of like, and he came out against Fuentes for good reason, by the way. I'm not saying he had ulterior motives, but that certainly was something that helped out his image. So I think we could have Casey on. You gave me his public email address, as I remember, K-Max. Thank you very much for doing so. I think Paul has his email. I know Paul has his email address too, so getting in touch with him should not be too difficult. I want to start getting more guests on the show this summer. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be chatting with Chrissy Mayer, and so I hope to start getting back to having one guest on the show each week. Should be fun. I think that I hope everyone can enjoy that. Although I do enjoy these shows, and I enjoy just the shows I do with Paul. So, I mean, it's not like I find the shows where there isn't a guest to be somehow less valuable than the ones where there is one. So that's that. But I do very much enjoy the guests. And I'm looking forward to the chat with Chrissy Mayer this week. It's going to be on the 13th at 7 p.m. At least that's what it's scheduled for. You never know if anything at the last minute will pop up to screw things over, but somehow I doubt it. I really enjoyed the chat I had with her, by the way, on her program. It was really great stuff. And I thank her for having me on. All right, everyone. I think this is it. I'm gonna double check because the last thing I want to do is is leave before not getting to someone's, you know, question, reasonable, responsible question or comment on Streamlabs. Just give me a minute and I will refresh the page, although in this case it's taking me a minute. I don't know why, but let's see here. Okay, let's see. I think I should be able to get it now. Refresh. Let's see. Hang on. This cartwheel is turning. It's spinning. It's spinning. It's spinning. And no, there's nothing else. No, that one from K-Max was the last thing. Guys, this was a great chat tonight. Thank you for showing up for my, you know, solo Q&A. I was feeling a bit down because I had not done one in a while, and I didn't think that was cool. So I'm glad I got to do another one. And I hope you've enjoyed this episode. It obviously will be out as an upload on Rumble and as a podcast next week. Thank you very much for tuning in. And I must say, if you've not done so already, please consider checking out my book on Amazon. I think it would definitely be worth your time. And I think you would get something out of it. I hope you would. It certainly was fun to write, as I keep saying. And the length is only 100 and how many pages are in this thing? It says here 191 pages. So it's not a long read, and as you could tell, it's not a very burdensome read. The pages are not like filled from here to here with text that's microscopic and footnotes and all that stuff. So I tried to write it as one would write an epic novel, and I think I succeeded, and I hope you'll check it out, and I hope you like it. It is free if you have Kindle Unlimited. I want to throw that out there again. So, you know, otherwise, I think it's pretty reasonably priced. And anyway, guys, that really is it for tonight. I'm doing one last refresh because I spoke longer than I thought I would, and you never know, maybe somebody threw something in at the very last minute, and I don't want to leave that person hanging. That really is it. So everyone, thank you very much for tuning in. See you next time. Before we go, though, if you like this episode and want to support the show, please consider donating to it by clicking on the PayPal link in the description below. Paul and I appreciate your generosity very much. Cheers, all.